So as we did with our other panelists, I'd like to kick it off, and if we could just go down the line, Christine, if you could get us started off, and sort of tell us how your experience intersects with the discussion that we're having today and sort of what brought you to this subject.
So I am a licensed attorney, so I'm an attorney by training. I ended up working in around the issues of commercial sexual exploitation just by virtue of being a research assistant for one of my professors in law school. One of my professors was working with an organization called the International Justice Mission, which does international human rights work. Their model has kind of an approach of it's a U.S.-based organization, but they'll work in other countries with the goal to ultimately completely turn over the management and human rights work in that country to nationals in that country. So as part of her work, she was looking at a piece of federal legislation called the PROTECT Act. Has anyone heard of the PROTECT Act? So it's an acronym for what I can't remember, but the essence of the law is that it allows the U.S. to exercise its jurisdiction over citizens who go abroad for the purpose of committing sex crimes. So essentially, if I maintain, you know, my residency in North Dakota, but I go to Thailand for the purpose of exploiting children, and I come back and the U.S. is able to gather evidence of that crime, they can charge me for that crime even though the criminal activity occurred overseas. So you can kind of see the nexus in with the issues of commercial sexual exploitation. So she and I kind of started working to educate our law school community around that issue. I ended up working overseas the following summer, working with an organization in Chiang Mai, Thailand, that was doing direct outreach into red light districts. Their goal was to develop a culinary arts academy to help women in that community have alternative options for survival. And then worked for the Polaris Project out in D.C. after law school. So I did a fellowship there and worked on domestic trafficking issues. So then I jumped back into just like regular private practice and learned how to be a lawyer for about 6 years or so. And then in 2014, I was awarded a Bush Fellowship, which allowed me to transition back into anti-trafficking work here in North Dakota. And as previous panels have mentioned, around that time there was a lot of talk and noticing the uptick in visible commercial sexual exploitation, and you know what people were talking about, just saying there's a lot of prostitution going on out west in association with the oil boom. So that is kind of getting this conversation started with a lot of different agencies about how we respond to that. As a result of those conversations, I joined a group of advocacy-based organizations that worked together to start FUSE, which was the state's first kind of grassroots coalition to combat trafficking. FUSE has kind of been the platform, I would say the FUSE development in Bismarck and then some of the development in the Red River Valley that Jen Poole will talk about kind of joined forces, and that's really the springboard by which our statewide coordinated work move forward. So, and we'll talk, I think, in more detail about what our current work looks like, but that's sort of the genesis of how I got involved. So you never know. Sometimes it can be like one job where you're just doing research for a professor and all of a sudden, like, there goes your career. If you'd have ever told me that moving back to North Dakota would have allowed me to focus my time full time on working on this, you know, I never would have guessed. But it's been really wonderful work and a really, I think, different way than I ever saw utilizing my legal background. But I use it every day in kind of helping people analyze the multitude of different issues we go through on a daily basis. So to close, my kind of current role then is working with youth work. So I work a lot with our direct service professionals. So working directly on helping them decide what we do with cases, how we coordinate with other agencies, how we best serve survivors of trafficking. Emily can probably give you our latest statistics as a state, but I think in the last year we served around 150? Yeah, so 78 new cases in 2016, 307 cases total that we're working. So just to give you an idea of the volume that we're working with. So there's my background.
I have been prosecuting child exploitation cases for the Department of Justice for about 16 years. And that included, until recently, child pornography, international sex tourism, which Christina touched on, online enticement, extortion, right. And some child prostitution, although very small numbers. As Christina said, the oil boom happened, and all of a sudden, sex trafficking specifically involving adults came on our radar. And that's something that we didn't have a lot of experience with, and we didn't have a network, or our services weren't set up to respond to that need. So I'm thinking back, I don't know how we all found each other, but we did somehow. We recognized very quickly that we could not prosecute these cases without the help of service providers. We have a lot of different limitations, and I think that's different than a lot of the other child exploitation cases. There's been a lot of talk about child pornography and sex trafficking. I think I view them as, and I think maybe Monique would agree with me, they're two very different types of crime. I want to make clear that child pornography, offenders of child pornography are preferential sex offenders. That is, they prefer to have sex with children. They meet the diagnostic criteria for pedophilia. People who are purchasing sex from sex workers are not, for the most part, are not pedophiles. They want to have sex, and they'll pay for it. And so we treat them differently. And albeit the women and children that are involved are still exploited, but it's a different offender. I digress, though. I just had to clarify that. At any rate, so we found each other, and it started off as a coalition, and eventually it led to a task force that receives both federal funding for the Department of Justice and state funding, too. So I serve on the executive board, and then Christina was our first director, and then she moved with YouthWorks, which is a service provider, and then along came Emily, and it's just been a great experience. And I work with these ladies weekly, and it's a great experience, as I said.
Oh, I can.
Sorry. I'm just passing.
So my name is Emily Schwartz. I'm the current director of the North Dakota Human Trafficking Task Force, and I've been in this position for about a year and a half now. We've been federally funded since 2015, and so we're still relatively new in the state and really continuing to expand knowledge and to build our systems to support human trafficking victims and prosecute the offenders. My background, I have a master's in public management. I attended graduate school abroad, and following graduate school, went to Geneva to do some work with the World Health Organization. A couple of the projects that I worked on there were looking at behavior change models and really trying to apply that to gender-based violence and seeing how we could examine effective campaigns that have been executed in other parts of the world and apply them to gender-based violence. So after returning to the States, I connected to Anna Frizzell, which is the way that I think that answers that question, how we all met. There's this really incredibly vivacious person in Fargo. She runs the Children's Advocacy Center. And I think the way that this all began was a case presented in Fargo. They had a victim come in for a forensic interview, and she was presenting very differently than maybe a traditional child sexual abuse case would, or a domestic violence case or neglect case. And so it took a lot of work on the front end to pull a group of people together and try and figure out how do we provide differently for this youth, what systems do we need in place to support this child who maybe isn't benefiting in the same way from our existing services and policies that we have in our organization. And so from that grew the Red River Human Trafficking Response Team. And then I was asked to write a protocol for the Fargo-Moorhead area, which was the beginning, I think, of our federal grant and looking at ways that we could roll that out into other parts of the state. So since then, we've been working on a lot of different issues, which I know we'll get to this afternoon.
I'm Joyce Smith, and I'm the Canadian in this bunch. And it's an honor to be here with all my American counterparts and colleagues. My story is much different. I have a master's degree in mathematics and science, a degree in music, and a couple of other degrees, and nothing to do with law whatsoever. But life happened, and my son, who's Royal Canadian Mounted Police, was in the Integrated Child Exploitation Unit 20-some years ago. And it affected him profoundly. We're a very close family, so I got him in, and I asked him what was going on. He said, kids are being bought and sold in our country. So, being a good teacher, I started giving seminars on how to protect your children over the internet. What I didn't bargain on was the kids showing up, showing me their tattoos, how one tattoo indicated they belonged to Rob. If it was changed, they belonged to Harry. I was enraged when I found out that Canada didn't have any laws to combat human trafficking. People were being bought and sold, and the ones I knew were all underage. So I decided to go to Parliament, and I did. And it drove me to pass two laws, mandatory minimums for traffickers of children 18 years and under. I learned how to write laws very quickly, very quickly. It was not because I was particularly smart at it. It was because my heart was breaking over the kids that were used and abused every single day. And I can remember one kid I rescued, and I remember bringing her out of a basement. She had been servicing men for a better part of a month. And I think that was the day my life changed, because when I took her hand to go upstairs, it reminded me of my own daughter. Her hand felt the same. She had beautiful long fingers, and I absolutely fell in love with her. And she had been abused for over a month before we got her out of there. That was my first experience at rescuing a victim. But I didn't know much about it, made a big mistake, took her back to the family, and found out that Daddy had been doing bad things to her for a very long time. That's why she ran away from school, and that's why she was on the streets. But having said that, I can tell you hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of those kinds of stories over the last 20-some years. And I can tell you, going to Parliament was not on my radar screen. I'm not a very good parliamentarian. My issue was human trafficking and stopping it. And by the grace of God, I was able to put two laws through. Number one, mandatory minimums for traffickers of children 18 years and under. In Canada now, if someone traffics a child 18 years and under, they have mandatory minimum sentences. It's embedded in the Criminal Code of Canada right now. The second one was Bill C-310, where we reached the long arm of the Canadian law into other countries, where we can, if a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident of Canada went abroad to sex traffic, do those wild things that they seem to need to do. Also, I wrote the National Action Plan for Canada, where that gave resources to frontline organizations who take care of children. And so the story goes on and on and on. So I guess it's really the love of children more than anything else, and the love of my son that drove me into this particular field. I've been in it this year 22 years, come this December. So it changed my whole life. And when I look at at you people today, and I listen to my wonderful colleagues who, I mean, this can be very draining. You have to do some self-care too. I'm the pot calling the kettle black, by the way. I don't do that very well. And I want to acknowledge Diane Redsky. She's one of my dearest friends. She is like a sister to me. And she's one of the foremost experts in Canada, in my opinion. Because she's a real McCoy. And along the way, you meet some real McCoys. And I'm a no-nonsense person. I don't have to do this. I don't get any money out of my foundation. I'm either crazy or just blind. But to have you sit here today and learn about human trafficking, I can tell you it touches every part of us in every way. And if you think it's not going to happen to you, or one of your extended family, you should get the documentary that just came out, Human Trafficking in Canada, Sacred Shame. That's Canadian, real people. It's not across the pond. And I tell you, there's a lot of trafficking between the U.S. and Canada borders. I know that from the survivors that I have spoken to. So anyway, that's why I started it.
That's a great transition, because you've talked about, we started out, how you guys got into it, a little bit about laws and creating laws designed to combat it. But I'm interested to hear, Christina, Emily, and Jennifer, how you guys work together. You guys mentioned we work together. You've mentioned different times prosecuting offenders. There's a lot of questions tied up in that. Sort of how does prosecution of offenders work? What other jobs do you consider that you have? But let's focus that first on how do you guys work together on prosecution?
I think that all three of us have worked together to develop sort of at different points, the system that we've created in North Dakota. And so I think the easiest way to answer your question is to kind of walk you through how a case is worked in North Dakota now. So what, and I guess I'll just start with the navigator stuff and then I'll pass it on. You guys can talk about other parts. But so what we sort of conceptualized in North Dakota as part of the North Dakota Human Trafficking Task Force is what we call a navigator system. And so YouthWorks, the organization that I work for, hosts the two navigators in the state. And so essentially what they are designed to do is be a single point of contact in accessing a collaborative group of professionals that will come together and collaboratively work a human trafficking case. So over the last 2.5 years or so, our navigators have worked to establish multidisciplinary teams in 10 communities across the state, and then with continuing work in other communities. And so so what happens really is that when a case is identified, and we serve victims of any age, and also right now we work with labor and sex trafficking victims. Our navigators will basically work, like I call it, like if you guys, okay, this might work with you guys because of your age, like Anchorman, the Will Ferrell movie, right? Like, news team, assemble! Like, that's what we do. Okay, I do that sometimes with different groups, and they just, like, look at me, and I'm like, I don't know what age group the Anchorman group, the Anchorman, like, joke sails with, but I think I did okay here. So, or like the Power Rangers, right, for all my 90s kids, like, you know, all come together. So that's really kind of what we do. And that at that point, really, it's about who's working this case, what's your role, and how do we make sure we're all communicating, because I think we'll get into this as the talk goes on, but you know, as I was listening to some of the other panelists, part of the reason that that approach is so necessary is that the vast majority of people that we work with have fallen through crack after crack after crack in systems. And so when the navigators and I talk a lot about the work that we do, it's really looking at being that kind of secondary level of a safety net and kind of looking at cases that are sort of failing to thrive in kind of our typical systems, and then figuring out how do we come together to sort of double down our efforts and intervene more successfully in this case. So our navigators start the process by getting prosecution, direct service providers, a lot of times social services, so like child protective services or foster care, someone from the Children's Advocacy Center all together to start working on how do we collaboratively work a case plan with this client. So.
Yeah, and typically a child or an adult enters the system in one of many different ways. It can be through social services. So she may present herself at a shelter. And our shelters that we work with now are trained to recognize and identify victims of sex trafficking. And then we will get a referral, law enforcement, federal law enforcement will get a referral from the shelter frequently through the navigator. The individual, the victim, may be first seen in a traffic stop, and the law enforcement officer is the first one to identify the child or the adult as a victim of sex trafficking. And so then it goes the other way. So then we're notifying the social services or the victim services, because we recognize very quickly that we will not obtain the cooperation of these victims if they're not stable. So the first thing that we need to do is address their immediate needs, food, shelter, and safety. And it's only after we do that that we can begin to get their cooperation for the prosecution. So all these things are going on at the same time. We have the law enforcement beginning the investigation. At the same time, we have the service providers that are addressing the victim's needs. Some happen quicker than others, and these investigations can go on for years. And then the prosecution starts, and the prosecution can go on for years. And during this entire period of time, we are utilizing our victim services. And those services change over time. And there are a lot of challenges.
I keep passing you my mic.
I think one case that really does a good job of illustrating this collaborative work is one that Jen recently prosecuted, the Collier trial. I'd just like to give a big shout out to her because it really does demonstrate how law enforcement and victim services work together. And just like you were saying, how those needs change over time. So maybe when a victim is first identified, it is really basic needs. I need a place to stay. I need food. I need, you know, someone to watch my kids. I need counseling services maybe. And so we try to provide that, which assists prosecution because victims who are feeling safe and cared for do a better job of testifying, right? So the trial goes on, and youth work staff continue to provide really wonderful victim services. And then the defendant decided to move to a pro se defense, right? Is that how I say that?
Yes.
Okay. And so all of these victims who had been prepared to be in the same room as that individual now had to change their reality, knowing that they were going to be questioned by him. And I'm sure you can imagine what that does to a victim, to all of a sudden be put on the spot thinking, here's this person who's been horrifying and terrifying me for years, and he gets to stand in my face asking me whatever he wants. And he did ask horrific things. And so the victim services staff really stepped up and were there 24/7, providing all the support that those individuals needed to make it through that trial. And Jen ended up with a successful prosecution, I think, largely because of that. We've seen it on the flip side as well, where law enforcement has just been an exceptional partner. I think historically, we don't think of victim services and law enforcement partnering very well together, and I do see that the issue of trafficking has really been able to foster a collaborative spirit between the two. And we are working with law enforcement officers. I'm thinking of one in particular at HSI who has just been exceptional in working with our clients. Yeah, Shane Conroy. And he has built such strong relationships with providers that he's the first call. You know, they know that he is going to treat that victim with exceptional respect, that he's going to follow through with those cases. And so it's relationships like that and people like that that get cases prosecuted, those kinds of building blocks.
Point one other thing out. When we encounter a child, it's much easier because we can take that child into protective custody and we can split the child up from the pimp. And it becomes a much easier case to investigate. And legally, we do not have to show force, fraud, or coercion. By definition, sex trafficking includes the prostitution of children. That's it. It's a much easier case. As soon as that victim turns 18, it becomes a harder case because we have to prove in the United States force, fraud, or coercion. And if we pick up that victim, and this is true for service providers or law enforcement, if that victim's encountered at 18, they have free will. I can't split up the victim from the pimp. And so we have to go at it very differently. So we're addressing service, or we're providing services to the victim, and we're also encouraging her, I hope, to come forward to law enforcement, and that looks very different when you're dealing with an adult versus a child.
Joy, you came into this at a different stage, which is trying to set up the law that these women are using to prosecute people. Has this issue of cross-collaborative case plan kind of work, this need to have law enforcement work with victim services, need to work with social services, has that played out in Canada as well?
Yes, it has, and I think I really love to hear the way you work together. I mean, that's amazing, and that's a really great model. It doesn't happen in all cases, but more and more, I know in Manitoba, we have a really good model there as well. But there's some issues, if you don't mind me talking about, that I would like to just expand on a little bit, because there are things that I think both Canada and the United States have to really collaborate on. And recently, in the recent R versus McCarroll, the Supreme Court of Canada interpreted our charter in such a way that it really supported the traffickers, and it had to do around cell phones. We all have cell phones, but what happens in one country, we're sister countries, happens in another country. And so the evidence was given special status to texting. So if a trafficker texted a victim and the victim received that text, then maybe the police couldn't use it because it wasn't admissible because it was a breach of privacy. And some judges are really shouting out, and some lawyers are shouting out saying, well, just a minute. I mean, there's admissible evidence in other cases. Why is texting so special? But that's R versus McCarrick right now, and I think that's something that we have to really watch. You know, at the breakfast table, we're also busy doing all the things that we're doing in our jobs. There's behind the scenes, one thing about going to Parliament, you find out all these things, unfortunately, but you find out these little whispers of technology, and technology is huge in the human trafficking thing right now, in the issue all across our countries. And I have to tell you that we as Canadians and you and Americans, I have a daughter who's now an American. She lives in Texas with her husband. So we're an integrated family, let's put it that way. I keep telling that to Diane because my son's married to an Ojibwa girl, so I tell her I'm really Ojibwa, but it holds no water, you know. But having said that, we do have to pay attention to our like things that could affect us in our jobs every day. And that is a very serious consideration. In fact, hearing the court's reasonable expectation of privacy, now is dangerously broadened with the cell phones and the texting. Well, I can tell you, in my opinion, I'm not going back to Parliament, but I do go to Ottawa and I do go to Washington quite a bit. And I have to say that texting is no different than any other thing when a crime is directed at an individual, and this individual particularly is a child underage, that's a crime. We should be protecting the traffickers. So that is one issue that I think also. And also, if you haven't noticed, the new NAFTA agreements worldwide are now putting social issues in there. Why are they doing that? Because NAFTA has never had social issues in before. That has to do with internet providers. That has to do with the money that countries make from internet providers. And so we need to really pay attention to things like that. I sort of got off. What was your question?
You've actually pointed me to something different that I actually think and get back to you three, which is, you know, we talked a little bit about how you guys work together to build a case. What kind of evidence? And let's talk about evidence apart from victim statements, because I do want to get to that, but I think that's its own issue. How do you build, using cell phone messages, hotel rentals, you know, what kind of evidence goes into building a case?
So, as a starting point, one of the goals that we have collaboratively, and we enjoy the support of prosecutors and law enforcement that really buy into this, and that's so critical, is that the goal is to have minimal victim involvement sometimes, if possible, in cases, meaning we're not going to rely exclusively on having a victim have to go up and recount every aspect of everything that happened to them in the criminal justice process. If we can, so having a victim, I forget how they say it, not victims, not victim reliant, but basically not having a victim reliant prosecution, right? That you don't have a case without the victim's participation. So Jen mentioned over lunch that they had the first successful conviction of a party where they had a non-cooperative victim in a case. So they had enough supporting evidence around the charge that they were prosecuting. They were able to move forward with the successful conviction without having a victim who was willing to talk about what had happened to them. So one of the things that I just, there's so much to talk about with the issue of trafficking. One of the things that I want to make really clear is that we are committed to collaborating, but in North Dakota, in any state in the country, victim service providers have very strict confidentiality laws that we respect. And we don't just respect them because it's on the books. We respect them because we want the services that we provide to our clients to be centered around what they want and need. And so sometimes that means that we aren't able to turn over information to law enforcement because a client doesn't want at that point, or maybe ever, to participate in the criminal justice process. So I think the relationships and the trust that we build between each other is really important, because we go back to that and say, you know, that it has nothing to do with the belief that I don't think that you would treat the victim appropriately, but it has to do with the fact that that the survivor, right? And I'm using the term victim too, just so you know, that victim means it's a particular role in a criminal justice proceeding, right? We talked earlier, Diane mentioned the importance of language and how we use language. But when you have someone who's the victim in a crime, that may not always be something that they're looking at as essential to their recovery in terms of dealing with that aspect of it. So we really try to make sure that our services are client-centered in the sense that we don't push someone into cooperating if they don't want to, but at the same time we're having conversations with them about raising that possibility. And knowing that we have really great relationships with really great law enforcement personnel who do function in a very victim-centered way helps that. So we have these trusting relationships that we've built where we're really in a position sometimes where we can say, you can talk to this person and they are trustworthy. And that carries a lot of weight sometimes with someone that's in our care with our agency. And so we benefit from that collaboration in that clearly the survivor or the victim of the crime would have a lot of information about their exploitation, but we work with service providers who understand ways, we work with prosecutors and law enforcement that really understand other ways to better develop a case that isn't exclusively reliant on victim testimony.
Yes, any good prosecution, you're going to find that there is evidence that substantiates what the victim says. And in the United States, even traffickers have a Fourth Amendment privacy right in their telephones, right? So we can't just open up their phone and look at it. We need to get a search warrant. So there needs to be probable cause that the phone was used in the commission of offense or contains evidence of a crime. And so I want to just make that clear. We have to do that, and we do that. And we find texts. We find we get hotel records. We get rental records. I recall the story, I think, is points out a couple of things. I recall interviewing a victim a couple of years ago, and we're getting ready for a trial, and she was telling, it was during the investigation, I guess, first, and she was telling me about all the vehicles she drove. They drove this vehicle to Florida, they drove this vehicle to New Orleans, because they always rented vehicles, and all the vehicles were rented in her name. And I said, oh my goodness, this was an 18-year-old girl, and I said, you have an incredible memory that you can remember, I mean, all these vehicles. I said, I don't even know that I'm sure that I know the make and model of my own car. And she told me that she started stealing vehicles at age 12. She was from Milwaukee. And I thought, wow, at 12, I was playing with Cabbage Patch Kids, right? And at 12 years old, this young lady was stealing vehicles. So it certainly tells a lot about the type of victims that we service. They are extremely vulnerable. They are disadvantaged youth, and because of that, they typically have lengthy criminal histories. They have distrust for law enforcement. And we need to make them credible. Jurors, they're not like a little girl scout girl up there and they're kind of crying. They're tough. They're tough victims. I mean, they have attitudes they've got attitudes. They're sometimes hard to service and they don't always look credible and they're certainly not always lovable. And so we have to substantiate in an investigation and a prosecution. We have to substantiate what they're saying. We have to, we believe them, but jurors aren't always going to believe them. And so we have to say that she said she was at this hotel. We have a hotel record. She said this happened to her. We have a text message that reflects that this happened. She said that she serviced these victims. That happened. What was really good is when you go and visit a John, and I never met with anybody. And then we say, well, this 18-year-old girl knows exactly what your living room looks like, what's your bedroom, and it's great. Oh, yeah, I guess I did, you know? So, I mean, they know a lot of information. They have credible detail, but any good prosecution will find corroborating evidence.
And I think one of the things to get back to, like, the question about what kind of evidence too is expert witness testimony.
Yes.
For a lot of juries, you really have to have somebody that comes in and says, it is part and parcel of doing this work that you're going to have inconsistent statements from the victim in this case. Because a lot of people will go, well, statement one didn't match statement two, didn't match statement three, didn't match statement four. That is actually, for people that do the work consistently, probably more corroborative of the fact that they've been trafficked than not, because we expect that there will be inconsistent statements. And so one of the things that we've increasingly done, and is really wonderful because we have both local law enforcement and federal prosecutors reach out to request that we help them find expert witnesses that can put that context around the stuff that the jury's hearing. So it may be one thing if a defense attorney says, well, didn't you say this on this date? Didn't you say this on that date? Da, 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 da. That initially really seems like it could be detrimental to a case. Then you get an expert witness that comes up and says, here's why survivors of trafficking tend to reveal only parts of their stories or things may change, etc. A lot of it has to do with trauma. A lot of it has to do with that they're a lot of times are coming from circumstances or backgrounds in which they don't have a positive relationship with police, and that we have to be aware of and understand and not view kind of the system in the way we maybe understand it and we've interacted with it, but how they have seen it and understand it, right? So putting context around all of that, because I think for a lot of people, if you're sitting in a jury pool and you've never had any orientation to this type of exploitation, you kind of expect that someone, if they were identified by police or by a service provider, would come out and be like, thank you so much for helping me. And that is not what happens, right? For a myriad of reasons. One, there's a lot of good people that intend to help many times that don't do a good job of that and then break down that trust. So it's like you may come to the table and say, hey, I'm here to help. And they're like, I know you think that, but my experience is, you know, the foster care system was supposed to help me and it didn't. You know what I mean? Like, this DV shelter was supposed to help me, and they didn't. Because I was accused of being a hooker when I was at this DV shelter. I mean, like, so there's a lot of stuff that goes on within these things where nobody's perfect. So when we approach these cases, both from the criminal justice kind of, like, understanding the evidence side and from our victim services side, kind of renormalizing what the experience is with these cases and understanding, how would you behave if you had survived all of this? You know, you can't walk around and be like a giant, trusting, open wound of a person and survive the things that a lot of our clients have survived. So they're tough. And they're tough because they survive and they rely on themselves. So I think a big part of the evidentiary hurdle is getting that context to a jury and making sure that our cases, you know, explain what to expect and why. So sometimes it's kind of flipping that perception of what people think a victim's going to act like and then how they actually act, and then explaining why that is.
Let me jump in with a quick question. And Emily, the answer may be you, so we'll find out. Who's the expert? Who are you putting on the stand? Who do you look for? Who do you find? What credentials? Who gets on the stand and provides that context?
Oh, I don't know if I'm doing it right. In the past, we've used a law enforcement officer, somebody who's been involved in the investigation of sex trafficking for many, many years. And we've had good luck with that. We've also explored...
Yes.
Who can talk about all these things that we're talking about. And what we're doing is we're doing a 101. Because I think so many people think that victims of sex trafficking want to be rescued. They do not want... I've been doing this now for a long time, and I've not met one victim who is self-identified, who's affirmatively gone to law enforcement and says, I'm a victim of sex trafficking. No, it's individuals, service providers, and law enforcement officers identifying. Or they have an encounter with the criminal justice system, and then we say, this looks like a victim of sex trafficking. So they're never self-identifying, and they do not want to be rescued. Those are two of the biggest misconceptions about sex trafficking. So when we put an expert on the stand, it's explaining all those things, explaining the inconsistencies, explaining the behavioral problems, talking about the fact that these people have criminal histories and what you can expect from them. We've also explored using a survivor. We get really great marks from folks outside of North Dakota about our task force use of survivors. Right? That's my understanding. We have one terrific survivor. Her name's Danielle John, and I think, has she even presented at UND before? I'm trying to remember. She was prosecuted federally in Chicago, seven, 8 years ago? Okay.
I think seven, six.
Okay. And so she has a lot of credibility. And she was prosecuted long before the victim-centered approach was being utilized by task forces, but we've had great experiences with her. How we use her is when we encounter a victim, we're calling our navigators, we're calling our service providers, and the law enforcement officers want her with on every instance because she gives them credibility. You know, because she can say, "I've walked in your shoes." You know, she understands the behaviors. She can cop attitude with them in a way that I certainly can't, in a way that law enforcement can't. And we have had a lot of success using her. And we've talked about using her as an expert, and I think we'd like to move in that direction. I know she has expressed interest in it, too. I know that other districts have used PIMPs, too.
I interrupted you.
That might be gone. I was just looking to kind of speak a bit more to the way that victims present.
Yes.
and better understanding trauma. And I think that sometimes victims aren't intentionally being really difficult. But when you think of, like, the sustained trauma that someone's experienced, like, I think sometimes we think about how difficult it is because we all maybe watch a little too much Law & Order SVU and expect things to line up just so. And so when you have an experience maybe with a child sexual abuse case and that kid didn't focus on their perpetrator's face, they focused on a picture on the wall, and that's what they took away. Like, I remember this piece, you know, or things that might seem incongruent to the story, that's the larger story that's being told. It's really difficult, I think, for a jury to reconcile that. And I think with a lot of our trafficking victims, you take that single experience and you multiply it hundreds of times. So when somebody's being asked to recall a specific instance, it can be really frustrating, you know, and somebody doesn't want to remember those things, and it's an awful experience, you know. So there's a certain level of self-protection, I think, that our trafficking survivors have, where they've, as a means of self-protection, you know, had to kind of wipe some of that from their minds too. And so I think it can be really difficult to corroborate. People like Jen, who are really great at their jobs, are really good, but I think it can be really intimidating for a lot of people starting out, which is why I would encourage all of you as attorneys to be, or existing attorneys, to really examine, you know, what trauma looks like in victims, and how you can work with victims so that they feel supported, and educate jurors as well.
Yeah, and so one of the things that that I think is really, it was really interesting to me, and I think when you have this conversation on the front end and understand why it may be necessary, it can be a positive thing across the board. It's certainly can be a flashpoint, but there are some organizations that will advocate for having what are called victim rights attorneys involved in the process as well. And I think the necessity and the benefit of having someone involved in that capacity really varies with the partnership and understanding of the prosecutorial agency. But sometimes, I'll give an example of kind of a case that is outside of trafficking, but we'll have young people who experience sexual assault. And being an attorney, I think I can say this, like, we all get sort of, we assume, like, this is how it goes, like, we're going to do depositions, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and it moves along, right? So in my agency, I work with a bunch of social workers, so they get a call from a lawyer saying they're going to go to a deposition, and they're like, okay, well, where and when? I come in and I'm like, wait a minute, this person's a victim of a crime, right? And they have rights to understand if they have to go to the deposition, under what circumstances, how does it work, right? And so part of all of this stuff, too, and I think when we do it carefully, it ends up benefiting everybody. You may have to work harder to get some corroboration and cooperation. Some cooperation from victims when they're informed and have a choice, but isn't that ultimately what we want? Right, that they understand what's going on, and that their lack of awareness about some things and how they proceed in the system isn't kind of used against them, because there can be a very understandable need to move things along. And sometimes, and I can say this as somebody who worked in the criminal justice system, sometimes you just lose some of those aspects. And so so our folks at Youth Work sometimes will work kind of in that capacity to advocate, but also for any of you who are interested in doing this work, there's another opportunity sometimes to advocate for people as the victim's attorney in their status as a victim of a crime. I'll give you another example. North Dakota now has what's called sexual assault restraining orders, right? I got contacted by a victim witness attorney a couple of months ago saying, hey, they filed this sexual assault restraining order through the state court system, and it's wide open, and it's sexual assault that's accused by one minor to another minor. So anybody that with a license can log on to the ND court system and pull the docket up and read the affidavit about the alleged sexual assault, right? That victim needs somebody to advocate for them within the system to say, hey, somebody should seal this record because people can read about my victimization, and all I'm trying to do is access help. So so there's another way there, too, to be involved in some of these cases where I've been able to reach out to attorneys that are interested in doing pro bono work to help us with these types of cases and when those issues come up. It's a really good opportunity to educate the system, because in my experience, like, say, with the deposition thing, the first thing was, no, she has to do this. And then when we came back and said, does she? It was like, well, here's why it would be beneficial for her to do this at this point, right? So the first sort of option can be, here's what has to happen. The second option can be, well, actually, it's what usually happens. So that's how we were proceeding. But you do actually have a choice in that. So there's all of that in there as well that I think complicates things sometimes. But I think in our experience, and I see you nodding when I'm talking about victim rights attorneys, like there's an acknowledgement that that can be helpful because it depends on the system you're in. Sometimes if you're maybe in a more rural area or somewhere that doesn't have experience with these cases, you need somebody that's there saying to the system, hey, the victim has a voice and the victim has an opinion in how this all goes down as well. We don't have that experience with Jen in the U.S. Attorney's Office because they're all really wonderful in Fargo, but we have certainly had that experience in other communities where we think that an advocate in there that's solely advocating for the victim would have been helpful.
And this last trial that Emily was just referring to, it was a 3-week trial, and it was last spring, and we had 5 victims. And the issue is not, are there going to be problems? It's how many and when, and for over a course of 3 weeks, you can imagine all the problems that we have. We had all these victims coming back to town. Some of them were in town. Some of them were coming back to town. One started drinking during the trial. That's how traumatic it is to talk about something, to talk about having survived this years later. One refused. She showed up, and then as soon as she found out that the defendant had gone pro se when it came time to question the victims, she just flat out refused to show up. So we had to go looking for her. One was an immigrant from Bosnia who was my best victim, and she fell apart on the stand because her family was in the courtroom. And so it was embarrassing. And after we figured this, we figured some things out. But a lot of these issues could have been solved, I think, if we had a victim's attorney. And the victim who I said just refused to show up, we had to send the marshals out to go get her, and we got a material witness warrant. We didn't want to do that. We had to do that. But then she was assigned an attorney, and it couldn't have worked out any better. And it worked out well because she had an attorney, and the attorney explained the process to her. We negotiated because, you know, she was now in custody, even though she hadn't committed a crime, but we negotiated, oh, we were going to bend some of these rules. We convinced the marshals to do it, all these things that we, you know, because she was a victim, and we had her in custody for maybe 12 hours, just long enough for us to go through things again and then get her on the stand and get her out. And we were still treating her like a victim, but it went well because she had an attorney. And I think some of these other issues that we had during the trial, certainly we had our service providers, and they did a tremendous job. We wouldn't have gotten through it without our service providers. Every single day there was an issue that came up with our victim. Our defendant was texting the victims. It was the first time that Judge Erickson, who's been on the district court for 16 years, has ever held a defendant in contempt because this defendant was doing everything he shouldn't have done. There was no court order that he was abiding by. He was texting. He was recording them. He was trying to record them. The defense attorney gave him his phone at one point. It was mess after mess after mess. But, again, I think a lot of these issues could have been avoided with an attorney.
And one, like, 10-second nugget on top of that, then I won't talk for the rest of the afternoon, I promise, is service providers, a lot of social workers, their orientation to a lot of this whole system is, like, I see that you're frustrated. Tell me, like, help me understand why you feel that way, right? Like, that's how they're appropriate. Where attorneys are like, oh, you think that's how it's going to go? This is how I'm going to tell you how it's going to go. It's a very different orientation. So sometimes bringing in attorneys that can help social service providers and victims advocate within the system can make a huge difference, because attorneys can go to service providers and be very intimidating and make them think there's one way this is going to go. And when you have attorneys that are on kind of the victim advocacy side, it can really help them stand firm in their position within this whole system, which is really important. So,
and that's really great, because we're getting from you two, Christina and Jennifer, right, the idea of what you as a lawyer could do, right, different possibilities, right, being a prosecutor, being a victim rights attorney. I'm curious to hear more from you, Jennifer and Emily, on as non-lawyers, and sort of the role that you play in combating this. Joy, and we haven't heard about Canada in a while. I'm wondering also, not to lay too much on you, but sort of how much what has been said about sort of the mentality of someone who has been through this also rings true for you.
Well, all the victims I've worked with, and I've actually worked with a number who really wanted to be rescued, so I didn't have 100% of them. In fact, most of them that I worked with did want to be because they were that somewhere along the line we had, they were in grave danger. And Mia, for instance, from out of Montreal, I worked with Dominic Marshall. He dealt with over, he was head of the Vice Squad in Montreal. He dealt with over 4,000 files. And Mia, for instance, was trafficked by the Russian mafia. And so they had trafficked hundreds of girls all across Canada down to the States. But what happened was she knew she was going to die because most of her girlfriends had disappeared. And so she decided one day she was going to get out. So she went to one of the drugstores on St. Catherine Street because traffickers not only traffic them for sexual purposes, but they also send them out to shoplift and things like that. It's modern-day slavery, and traffickers put the goods on Kijiji, and they make money out of them every way they can. And one night when she had finished servicing 40 men, she decided she'd rather die than do this again. So the next day she went to the drugstore, and when her trafficker said, "You've got a shoplift," what she did was stuff her coat filled with goods, and she wanted the security guard to see her, and he did. And to top it off, she kicked him to make sure she'd get into the police station. Dominique Marchand was there. That particular girl we hid for a year because she had a photographic memory. She was an amazing girl, and she testified against the Russian mafia, but the judge threw the case out for some reason. I think a cop had forgotten to apparently hand in a notebook, but we wondered about this whole situation. So we hid her for a year. She went back, and in the end, this very brave girl brought the Russian mafia down. I mean, it was just amazing. And I was an MP at the time, so I was able to deport him back to Russia. Putin's taking care of him. He had an Israeli, passport. But so there's been a variety of things, but just one thing I want to say, I think it's great the way this local group of people deal with what they're doing. It's amazing. And the collaboration they have is just amazing, and their enthusiasm. But one thing I just wanted to say before we go is that what we're also doing through the foundation is trying to prevent it from happening. So we've written, because the girl that comes home, if she comes home, is never the girl that leaves home. And so we have a curriculum grade 8 to 12 teaching the kids how predators, how to recognize a predator, what grooming is, and to try to prevent as much as we can. So all of us working together can make this happen, I'm sure. When you see a dynamic team like this, and I've heard from, we used to put together task force all across Canada. Diane Ritzke was part of the Women's Foundation Task Force, amazing task force, one of the best we had in Canada. These task forces are really important. And along with that is community knowledge. We're trying to education, because we believe education is our greatest weapon against this horrendous crime. To be quite frank, we don't have enough laws, we don't have enough police officers, we don't have enough social workers. Our nations have to work together as a community to help this by the prevention side, and that's the only thing I wanted to add to that.
You know what, I'm realizing I'm being cognizant of time. I want to make sure that you all have your ability to ask questions that you have in the audience. Does anybody have questions for our panelists?
There's a variety of ways. Like, number one, Mia made it so obvious that she landed up in the police station. And, you know, she didn't have a very good experience with police. But more and more police all across North America are becoming educated. So Dominique knew how to do it. And they took down the Russian mafia, which was great. Another incident was a girl who was in a hotel, and she slipped a message to the concierge and said, you know, I'm being held in this. This was in Toronto. She was 14 years old. And there's a variety of ways. So we've had a mixture. Traffic victims get something called Stockholm Syndrome, and they do get attached to their traffickers because they also miss a lot of education, so they don't know what can they do? Because everyone that they trusted, they mistrust now because they've exploited them or trafficked them. So I'm just saying it's a variety of ways, and I can understand, you know, there are different situations in different locales, but we've had the variety.
And I think it's helpful at this point, too, for me to clarify what we mean by saying that victims don't want to be rescued. Most survivors that we work with, if they have been trafficked for a period of time, are very, very aware that they are, they don't feel like there's anyone else necessarily looking out for them, right? And so these are not naive people that don't know how to get by and take care of themselves. So a lot of their behaviors, a lot of the ways they are exactly that. It's survival instincts. I just want to be clear that what we're trying to say is that there are certainly cases where someone will, and we've had a handful of survivors that have been really upfront about what's happened to them. I think the danger in expecting that victims of trafficking will seek out assistance is that we will miss the vast majority of people who are being victimized, because most people who are being victimized will look like willing participants in prostitution. So if we allow this fallacy of kind of this no harm, no foul commercial sex industry to persist, you can just, so go back and look, Google prostitution Watford City 2012. All of the local media coverage was about this increase in prostitution in hotels. That's how it was covered. Because no one, they're seeing people go in. Okay, let me give this example from the Graves trial, federally prosecuted in Bismarck. It was another pimp who was switching back and forth between being pro se and using an attorney. And he's pro se, and one of the survivors is up on the stand testifying. And there is video footage from a 7-Eleven or somewhere in, like, Stanley, North Dakota. And it shows this victim getting out of the car, walking into the 7-Eleven, milling around, looking at products and stuff, and he's nowhere to be found in the video footage. And you know what he does in the trial? Look, am I looking at the same video you are? Looks like you could have run at any point if you were being abused. How come you didn't take off? You're not in this video footage anywhere. I'm nowhere near you. Why didn't you go ask for help? And that's a really effective defense strategy with a jury. And it's always used. And so when we say that people don't want to be rescued, it's more understanding why a survivor who, very clearly, that woman had been raped within the half an hour before they got to that gas station by her trafficker, why she wouldn't run up to the cashier and say, help me, right? Because if we can't communicate that, that's where, so when we say that they don't want to be rescued, I just want to be really clear that we're not saying that anyone does not want to exit what's going on with them. It's that we have to be aware that it won't always play out that they will even look like they're being victimized. And that's the vast majority of, I think, Jen and my experience in working with survivors, is that it's not readily apparent.
I just want to speak to that, because that's very true. They don't appear like they need to be rescued. And that's very common as well. So thanks for clarifying that, because I was kind of surprised when I heard it. What? Okay, thanks.
My advice would be to get involved with domestic violence, sexual assault, and runaway and homeless youth providers. Those are the people that are at risk of being trafficked. My agency works with a kind of a continuum of kids that are involved in the foster care system, that are involved in needing transitional living, that are aging out of foster care. And I see that our trafficking work as is it on that same continuum of victimization of other, you know what I mean, of that vulnerability. And so really starting to understand what are the root causes that lead people to be vulnerable to trafficking is really important. So, and a lot of those agencies are operating on shoestring nonprofit budgets, so pro bono legal help is really helpful.
I really appreciated one of the last panelists' comments. She's not here anymore, is she? The history professor. Nikki, yeah. Everybody has sympathy for the child. No one says, yeah, I'm in favor of sex trafficking children. But as soon as we start talking about adults, and one of the biggest misconceptions about sex trafficking is that the majority of the individuals that are trafficked are children. It's not true. Most of them are adults. Now, they get involved when they're children. I think I've heard statistics that the average age is anywhere from 14 to 16. But when we encounter them, when we're first encountering, whether it be through our shelters or they have an encounter with law enforcement, it's as an adult. And when that's the case, I have to prove force, fraud, or coercion. And that is the most difficult element to prove. I have to show that they would not have engaged in it unless they only engaged in it because they were compelled to do so. And that doesn't, it's not limited to physical force, although people think that, just as Christina said, that if there's not a gun to their head, they're doing it voluntarily. And that's just not true. There's more subtle forms of coercion. And so I think we have to talk about that, and we have to talk, I think we have to talk, and it comes part of the public discussion, talk about sex trafficking of adults. That's a problem. And these people aren't willing participants. I think there's so many people think, oh, children, yes, we got to do something about the children, and we do. That's very important. But as soon as that child becomes 18, it's remarkable that all of a sudden, the majority of people that, like in the community I talk to, they're willing participants. It's voluntary. They can walk away, the defense that Christina just referenced is the defense in every single sex trafficking case. They have footage. They have examples. They could have walked away. They weren't living together. So that's what we have to talk about. I think we have to make that more part of the public discussion. The sex trafficking of adult women.
The task force is looking for people who are very interested. So please contact us if that is an interest of yours. I think that. Level of experience doesn't matter all the time. I would rather have somebody who's really engaged and young and excited to learn about everything than somebody who's not as interested in serving victims. So know that everyone has a lot to offer, and to get in touch with us if that's something that you'd like to do.
Hello. We had a client who didn't tell us her real name for 14 months. Just in terms of showing up and being there, and trusting them and, like, supporting them. 14 months into working with her, now we know what her name is, so.
And I think that's actually a great place to stop, is to talk about all that we can do. But I do want to invite Victoria back up here. I know that there's still some more announcements before we let you all go from the Law Women's Caucus.